stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. U.S. President Barack Obama is calling on Britain's young people to reject pessimism, cynicism, and xenophobia in London today, one day after dealing with stinging criticism over his remarks expressing support for Britain to stay in the European Union. The U.S. president told a town hall meeting of youth that globalization and integration should be seen not as threats, but as opportunities. He told those gathered that right now is the best time ever to be alive.
If you could choose one time in history where the chances that you led a fulfilling life were most promising, you choose right now.
On this visit to London, Mr. Obama has also, again, stepped into the debate whether the country will stay in the EU, urging British voters to remain in the Union in a June referendum. That is in support of Prime Minister David Cameron's position, but it's likely to come up during a closed-door meeting today with the British Labour Party. German Chancellor and top EU officials traveled to Turkey today to try to smooth over tensions that have arisen after an EU-Turkey deal last month to curb the number of migrants pouring into Europe. Angela Merkel, European Council President Donald Tusk, and First Vice President of the European Commission Frans Timmermans were greeted by the Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu on their arrival in a city close to Turkey's border with Syria. The European leaders are expected to visit a refugee camp and then negotiate the deal further behind closed doors. South Korea's military says North Korea's submarine-launched ballistic missile test does not appear to have been a success. The South Korean Joint Chiefs of Staff said today a projectile was fired from a submarine toward the sea. The Associated Press reports the U.S. State Department would not comment on the launch, but said that such tests are a violation of U.N. sanctions and resolutions. This is VOA News. More than 170 countries have signed an agreement at the U.N. aimed at limiting the rise of global temperatures and slowing the effects of climate change. Secretary of State John Kerry represented the United States at the U.N. signing.
All of this is what we now know definitively is what is going to define the new energy future, a future that is already being defined, but even yet to be discovered.
The so-called Paris Agreement still has to be ratified in each of the signing countries. Four academics and two journalists are on trial in Turkey in separate cases related to increasingly restricted free speech in the country. The academics face charges related to producing what prosecutors describe as terrorist propaganda after signing a declaration condemning Turkey's military action against Kurdish rebels. The journalists are in court for a third hearing in their espionage trial, and they could face life in prison over a story published alleging the Turkish government smuggled weapons to Syria. Turkey researcher Emma Sinclair Webb of Human Rights Watch.
Basically, this means you can go after any kind of government critical political opponent on the grounds that they are somehow promoting, in the vaguest terms, terrorism. So it's an extremely worrying move.
Turkey's European and U.S. allies are voicing growing concern for freedom of expression and other human rights in Turkey, but the country is dismissing the concern, saying it faces unprecedented terror threats from Kurdish rebels and Islamic State militants. Authorities in northwestern Bangladesh say several assailants with machetes have attacked a university professor in the city of Rajshahi. The 58-year-old professor was an advisor to several cultural programs. No one has claimed responsibility for the attack, and a motive is not immediately apparent, but police say it is similar to other attacks carried out by Islamic militants. Earlier this month, the U.S. offered resources and expertise to the Bangladeshi government as Dhaka investigates the latest in a series of murders of secular bloggers in the country. Medical examiners have now performed an autopsy on the legendary U.S. musician Prince, trying to determine why he died on Thursday. Jim Olson is the sheriff in the area, and he spoke with reporters about the procedure.
Dr. Quinn Strobel, who is a Carver County medical examiner, responded. There were no obvious signs of trauma on the body at all. The body was transported to Dr. Strobel's office for an autopsy, and that is being done today. Results from that autopsy may take several weeks, which is not unusual.
During his 35 years in the music business, Prince sold more than 100 million albums worldwide, won 7 Grammys, and picked up an Oscar for Best Original Song Score for the movie Purple Rain. He was 57 years old.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Elections in any meaningful fashion as to a selection of a country's leader in the West, in the United States, or virtually anywhere else. This is the reimposition of a dictatorship.
Citizens of Equatorial Guinea go to the polls Sunday.
Every day that Riek Machar does not come to Juba raises the tensions and raises the chances of an explosion. That, it seems to me, is an unreasonable delay.
South Sudanese rebel leader Dr. Riek Machar's expected return trip to Juba on Saturday is delayed again.
I followed specific instruction. Count the number, make sure they are buried in a dignified way, and know where they are buried.
And a report by Amnesty International says hundreds of people were killed by the Nigerian military in a clash with a Shia Muslim sect in the northern city of Zaria in December. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Citizens of Equatorial Guinea go to the polls Sunday to choose a new president. It is expected that longtime president Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo will win re-election. Exiled opposition leaders say Sunday's poll is unlikely to be free, fair or transparent. Mbazogo is currently the longest-serving African head of state and could serve another 7 years in office if he wins the vote Sunday. John Bennett, former U.S. ambassador to Equatorial Guinea, told me the vote will not be credible.
I think the first thing to understand is that these are not elections in any meaningful fashion as to a selection of a country's leader in the West, in the United States, or virtually anywhere else. This is the reimposition of a dictatorship that's existed since the late 1960s and specifically since August the 3rd, 1979.
Is there any specific opposition party that could significantly challenge the ruling party and, for that matter, President Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbazogo?
I think if there are groups who have opposed him, individuals and groups who have opposed him for many, many years, decades. However, he has managed to neutralize them, put them in jail, or otherwise discourage them. He's co-opted many. But there is no meaningful opposition in the sense that he would allow an opposition party to oppose him, no.
Some people have expressed concern that some observers that go to the poll usually give the administration of the election a clean bill of health. You think that is not justified?
Well, the process goes forward, but the results are the reimposition of a dictator. There is, in that sense, it's a reaffirmation or re-election, automatic re-election of a man who has run the country since he took over from his uncle in 1979.
You were in the country, you were an ambassador of the U.S. there. What do you see as the judicial system in the country? Because issues of gross human rights violations have been raised. The government has, on numerous occasions, rejected them as a figment of the imagination of opposition or outside groups trying to interfere in the internal democracy, as they say, of the country. What is your take?
There is no judicial system that has any power to come to decisions other than the dictatorship wishes, period. I've written a few articles, I've contributed probably more to articles in books and in magazines and so on, but basically is that there has been a dictatorship there for decades, and it is a control of one man who has managed not only control the politics of the country, but also the entire income of the country. And the good news, of course, was that oil was exploited from the mid-1990s when I was there in Equatorial Guinea, which I promoted, certainly with the American companies there. But the entire income from that oil was taken by Obiang Nguema Mbazogo and divided out among his cronies and himself mainly. His son probably took well over $100 million, which he invested or spent in some fashion in the United States. $100 million is a lot of money to give to your eldest son, which he did. And he remains in power. He calls elections when he wishes, more or less every few years, according to a constitution which he has revised occasionally during his many years in power. But there is no freedom in the sense of free elections or a free economy or anything else. Nothing can help but happen in the country without his approval or the approval of his family, period. Nothing major.
Ambassador Bennett, why hasn't the international community taken action based on petitions or requests by these opposition groups who basically, some have said, have been hounded out of the country or chased out of the country by security agencies?
Sadly, to a great extent, it's been a get-along, go-along international community that, one, needs the oil, and also, for example, with respect to the United States, the oil companies facilitated a very powerful, very effective press campaign through professional image managers so that he was acceptable enough to come and go as he wished and get paid for his results and ignored the crimes that he had committed in the 60s and 70s and now is remains in power. So it has been, to some extent, a fault. There's been no reason, for example, that he's been allowed to come to the United States on a visa any more than Robert Mugabe.
John Bennett is a former U.S. ambassador to Equatorial Guinea. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. South Sudanese rebel leader Dr. Riek Machar's expected return to the capital, Juba, planned for Saturday, was delayed after President Salva Kiir's government demanded its team inspect weapons that Machar would bring along. The government's demand came shortly after a cabinet meeting on Friday. James Gadech Dak, the official spokesman for Machar, told me the latest surprise demand by the government is an indication that Kiir's government lacks commitment to carry out the full implementation of the peace accord.
We have just received a new demand from President Salva Kiir's government saying that they will yet send a team to verify the weapons. So we are surprised that the government has come up with this new demand today, yet want to verify these weapons when the Ethiopian government, which is now in charge of the weapons at the airport, has already verified and has communicated this. So it has implications on the schedule of the first vice president for his travel to Juba. Actually, the chief of general staff, General Simon Garwich, was supposed to travel ahead of Machar. So the delay has been caused by this, and they are several hours behind the schedule. I'm not sure if they are going to make it to Juba today.
So does that mean that Dr. Machar's anticipated trip to meet the deadline of the international community to arrive in Juba today is unlikely to be met?
Yes. The verification has not yet been done. We learned that they have sent the team, is on the way coming to Gambela, a border town near Pagak, South Sudan border. And if they arrive, then they are going to do the verification. I don't know how long it will take to do the verification. And after the verification, that's when they will now give permission for landing of the aircraft that will airlift the forces. And this, again, will take time because the aircraft is not yet on the ground now at the airport in Gambela. It is waiting for the clearance first. It will take another time. So I don't know whether this will be possible today or whether both the Chief of General Staff and the First Vice President Designate will travel today, both of them.
Has your group approached the JMEC about these new concerns and demands by the government?
Yes, our group in Juba, our chief negotiator, Taban Deng, has approached the JMEC about this new development. And the JMEC is in contact with the government of South Sudan to try to resolve this.
So what implications does this new demand have on the peace deal itself as it stands now?
It will cause a further delay for the formation of a transitional government of national unity, which is needed for implementation of the peace agreement. So if the verification will further delay the travel of the first vice president designate, this means that the formation of the government of national unity will also be delayed.
Some supporters are saying that indeed the government needs to know what kind of ammunition that the first vice president designate is coming with, despite information out there. They need to verify it for themselves to ensure a fair accountability. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it is not necessary, because the number and the specifics of the weapons have been declared. The list has been provided to the government, to JMEC. They know how many AK-47 weapons are going to be brought in by the forces. They know how many forces are coming, which is 195. They agreed that, yes, the number of PKM weapons is going to be 20. The number of RPGs is going to be 20. So this information has been provided, and they have agreed. And the Ethiopian government in Gambela airport has also verified the number of the weapons and the types, and they have locked them in boxes. Even our forces at the airport have no access to these weapons now, because the Ethiopian government is the one in charge. They have locked them in boxes, and they have verified the number and the types. And also the chairperson of the Joint Military Committee, which is to verify this weapon, is an Ethiopian general. So I don't know why the government would still insist that they want to verify this weapon by themselves and not the body or the Ethiopian government, which is in charge of this weapon now.
So nobody knows when the government inspection team will arrive in Gambela to inspect the weapons?
We have learned that they are on the way, they are in the air. I don't know when they are going to arrive or when they will start to do the verification.
James Gadet Dak is the official spokesman for the South Sudanese rebel leader, Dr. Riek Machar. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Eric Reeves is professor at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. He has spent many years working as a Sudan and South Sudan researcher and analyst. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him for his take on the delayed return of rebel leader Dr. Riek Machar.
But I think what's important to bear in mind is that every day that Riek Machar does not come to Juba raises the tensions and raises the chances of an explosion. That, it seems to me, is an unreasonable delay. At the same time, the government of South Sudan is making things more difficult than they need to be. For example, Michael Makwe Lueth, who is one of the real hardliners, one of the people who's been least cooperative in the whole process, has objected to the proposal by the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Committee, proposal put forward by Chairman Festus Mogae. Now, this is, even as McQuay says, this is not it's not the weaponry per se, he says, but it's rather that a demand was made by the opposition. Well, that's the kind of attitude that it seems to me is going to make it harder for Riek Machar to return. I think he should have returned, even without an agreement on some of the very small details about weaponry. This is not what's going to determine the future of South Sudan. What's going to determine it is a willingness, once Riek Machar has returned to Juba, a willingness by all parties to put peace in South Sudan above all other considerations, including considerations of political power and personal interest.
Dr. Reeves, political power and personal interest aside, shouldn't Riek Machar be concerned about his security at least?
It's very difficult to say he should not be concerned about his security. Thabo Mbeki's brother was killed in Juba not so long ago. There are a lot of people with a lot of hostility on both sides, and I think I worry as much about Salva Kiir's being assassinated as I do about a member of the SPLA in opposition, whether Riek Machar or Thabo Mbeki, who has done yeoman's work in recent months. But there are a lot of guns, and there are a lot of very angry people, and that's why I say every day that Riek Machar delays returning simply increases the pressure, the intensity, and the stress level that are going to make it more difficult to get down to the business of putting South Sudan together again.
Putting South Sudan together indeed needs to happen. But allowing each warring faction to assemble and control large forces in the capital, Juba, seems like a recipe for disaster, according to some analysts. Do you think this part of the deal was a good idea?
There is a great danger if just a few individuals act irresponsibly. A few hundred more troops or a few more weapons of a different sort cannot possibly change the security dynamic in Juba. Thabo Mbeki is there. Salva Kiir is there. Riek Machar needs to be there. If security is not ideal, it's not going to get any better with any negotiations that take place going forward. It is time for Riek Machar to do what he can to bring about the process that is going to bring peace, true peace, to Sudan and end the kinds of animosities, ethnic and political, that are tearing South Sudan apart, not as violently as in 2014, 2015, but the potential, the ongoing potential for enormous destruction of the sort we did see previously remains. And those tensions need to be diffused, and they can only be diffused when all the parties are in Juba. It can't be done while Riek Machar remains in Bagak.
Eric Reeves is a professor at Smith College in Massachusetts. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from Northampton. A Zimbabwean human rights activist has published a book about her abduction and torture by a state security agent in 2008. Rights groups say the book is an important reminder that such abuses continue in Zimbabwe. For VOA, Thuso Kumalo has more from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Justina Mukoko says state security agents abducted her from her home outside Harare on December 3, 2008. She has now published a book detailing the torture she says she suffered during the 3 weeks that followed.
They were bashing the soles of my feet. That went on for hours. I was made to kneel on gravel. You know, the small stones piercing through your skin. The pain is unbearable.
In her book, Mukoko says, agents also exposed her to very loud music day and night and interrogated her for hours on end. She says her abductors handed her over to the police, who took her to court on charges of plotting against the government. She was released on bail in March 2009, and a judge ruled in September that her rights had been violated. Mukoko is the director of the Zimbabwe Peace Project. She says the government targeted her in 2008 because she was investigating rights abuses committed by state security forces during elections earlier that year. Advocates groups say her story is not an isolated one and that people who speak out against the government of Robert Mugabe continue to face intimidation, arrest, and other abuses. Activists marched in Harare in March to demand an investigation into the disappearance of journalist and activist Itai Zamara in 2015. Deoma Vinga is a senior researcher in the Africa Division at the Human Rights Watch.
What happened to Justina Mukoko can happen to other people. Continues to happen. We have a recent abduction last year of Itai Zabara. He remains disappeared outside the protection of the law. So this is important to show that these things are happening. And more importantly, there hasn't been yet accountability.
Zimbabwe's government says there is no impunity for abuses. The chairperson of the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, Elasto Mungwadi, told VOA that Mukoko can file a complaint and the commission will investigate her case. But Mukoko says she has little faith in the authorities. She says she wrote her book to comfort others who have had similar experiences but are afraid to come forward.
The challenge that we have before us is to heal those wounds. And we need to be able to look back and say, oh, we don't want that to happen again.
Since her release in 2009, Mukoko has remained in Zimbabwe and continued her work. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Amnesty International says hundreds of people were killed by the Nigerian military in a clash with a Shia Muslim sect in the northern city of Zaria in December. The report's release Friday comes as the government filed charges that carried the death penalty against hundreds of the group's surviving members. For VOA, Chris Stein reports from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos.
In December, residents of the Kaduna suburb Mondo noticed a massive hole dug in a remote part of their local cemetery. It was then filled almost as quickly as it had been dug. What they only found out later was that it was full of bodies. A Kaduna state official told VOA that inside the mass grave were the corpses of 347 people killed in a clash between the military and the Islamic Movement of Nigeria, a Shiite sect based in Zaria. Amnesty International's senior crisis response advisor, Donatella Rivera, says what took place there was a massacre. A report from the rights group says soldiers shot children in the head and set a building full of wounded people on fire, then tried to cover it all up. In addition to those buried in the mass grave, the Shiite group says a further 350 of their members remain missing.
The Nigerian military went to extraordinary efforts to cover up their crime, to destroy the evidence, And this is very striking.
The military says soldiers fought back after members of the sect tried to assassinate the chief of army staff as he passed through Zaria. Spokesmen for the military declined to comment on Amnesty's findings. Rivera says both the military and Kaduna State are complicit in covering up the deaths of hundreds of people. One state official says he was merely doing his job. Namadi Musa, an advisor to the government on religious matters, told VOA that Kaduna's governor asked him a day after the clash to travel to Zaria and ensure that 347 corpses released by the military were given a proper burial.
I followed specific instruction. Count the number, make sure they are buried in a dignified way, and know where they are buried.
A state commission of inquiry is investigating the incident. State officials this week filed charges against a group of 50 people arrested after the clash. A lawyer for the group, Festus Okoye, says he expects a total of 265 people to be arraigned in the coming weeks. Of those, 255 will face charges of culpable homicide, which carries the death penalty. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the politics of South Sudan, reconciling and uniting the nation. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk Etiquette. It's the customary code of polite behavior in society. Are you aware of people's behavior in public? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing etiquette. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
and you're listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, and coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy what we have for you today. Baby, dance, dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah. Hallelujah, Hosanna, girl, you I want. Get your body, banana, sweet in my heart.
Girls, and you already know that I'm a girl. just want to have fun. But, we just want to burn castles. Cause you give me your love and you give me your heart. Baby, I will never tear it apart. Yeah. Only you, they make me happy, oh. Only you, they make me happy, yo. And I feel like a celebrity, yo. Nobody can control my body, yo. What's up? You are so nice, I draw you my clear. Something about you, girl, 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 say, say, say.
Girl, I just want to love you right. But it goes so
better. We just want to have fun. Better. We just want to burn castles. Cause you give me your love and you give me your heart. Baby, I will never tear it apart. Yeah. Only you, they make me happy, yo. And I feel like a celebrity, yo. The way that you rock in your body, yo.
You know, say my baby's a pretty fine, yeah. Yeah. You know, say we just wanna have some fun, yeah. Cause now you and they make me happy, yeah. And I'm willing to spend all my life with you, baby. For better, for worse, yo. Yeah, for fire, don't fart, yo. Carry you to my damn, yo. I give it to you, baby. I say make it just follow me. Be okay, you follow me, follow me. Be okay, hey, melody, melody. Be okay, yo. Harmony, harmony, yo. Baby, yo.
Okay. Only you they make me happy, yo.
Just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go beg it. Oh girl, so when you're ready, just let me know, no. Ooh, what a wine, you got it, baby. Get fine for your love. And I feel too bad for your love. The kind of love me get for you, no be joke. Can you don't carry me go. Anywhere you enter, can you scatter? You make a man spray you in dollar. Every day I won't see that your face. I can't do it at today. I won't see that your face again, no. I can't do it at today. You say make a wait, girl, I will wait. Whenever you're ready, just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no. Ooh, what a wine, you got it, baby.
Sexy like my on the floor. Oh yeah, shaggy di bobo. Yeah, when I see you, oh boy, I confuse so. Confuse. Yeah, I say wait till you ask, I don't go refuse so. I don't go refuse. Yeah, and I go DJ for you whenever you're down. I say for you, them girls they go bound. They go get a story all over the town. Your papa they vex, I go beat down the house.
You say make a wait, girl. I go wait.
So,
you are ready, just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go wait. Oh girl, so when you're ready, just let me know, no.
Ooh,
what a wine,
kai
jebe,
kai jebe,
kai jebe. What a wine,
ebelebe,
whoa. You don't know. What a wine,
kai jebe,
whoa. Girl, I go wait.
Girl, I go wait. Oh.
So whenever you are ready, just let me know, no.
Yeah.
You say make a wait for your love, I go wait.
Girl, I go wait. Oh.
So when you're ready, just let me know, no.
Yeah.
Rain on the mix.
Rain on the mix. Oh, yeah.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and engineer for today, Jonah Cummings, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I remember, as the elders say, the road doesn't tell the traveler what lies ahead. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On a recent trip to the Lake Chad Basin, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power spoke out about the growing threat of the terrorist group Boko Haram. On a stop in Cameroon, she announced nearly $40 million in new humanitarian assistance to support people throughout the region whose lives have been devastated by Boko Haram violence. An estimated 9.2 million people are suffering displacement, deprivation, and disease from the consequences of armed conflict in the Lake Chad Basin region. 7 million of those in need are in Nigeria, including 2.2 million internally displaced persons. As a result of the prolonged crisis, communities who have generously hosted IDPs have also exhausted their resources. There are nearly 170,000 Nigerian refugees who have fled to Cameroon, Chad, and Niger, countries whose citizens have also suffered from Boko Haram attacks and consequent displacement. This new funding brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance for the Lake Chad Basin region to more than $237 million over the last 2 years. Assistance will allow the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees to provide Nigerian refugees with access to clean water and sanitation facilities, health care, essential household items, shelter, programs which protect children, and activities to prevent and respond to gender-based violence. Boko Haram has killed as many as 20,000 people. Last year alone, the terrorist group launched 159 suicide bombings, more than half in Nigeria. A new report by UNICEF states that Boko Haram increasingly uses girls to set off explosives. Ambassador Power stressed that defeating Boko Haram cannot be done through a military response alone. Governments in the region, she said, must understand the centrality of political inclusion and economic development to the long-term ability to keep Boko Haram not just out of territory, but to defeat Boko Haram in the long term. This requires a comprehensive strategy, said Ambassador Power, one that includes respect for human rights, political inclusion, economic development, and, of course, physical security provided by the police and on the borders by military forces. The United States stands with all who are fighting the terrorist scourge of Boko Haram and urges other donor countries to join in responding to the humanitarian crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.